Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oklahoma Center for the Humanities at the University of Tulsa kicks off a year-long focus on food, this essential element of life, with an interdisciplinary approach featuring lectures, debates, readings, exhibitions, and more throughout the academic year. This thematic focus gets underway this evening with a lecture by Philip Howard, an associate professor in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University, who will examine how packaged food and beverage makers influence our consumption patterns. Howard is a member of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems and the author, most recently, of Concentration and Power in the Food System, Who Controls What We Eat? He'll be speaking tonight on Food and Power, How Big Corporations Shape What We Eat and Drink, looking at three specific products. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock in the Tyrrell Hall Auditorium in a free lecture sponsored by the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Philip Howard, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In your book, Concentration and Power in the Food System, and in this lecture tonight, you're going to be talking about how really it's four big corporations control a lot of the way our food journeys from being grown to being consumed. Can you give us a sense of who these corporations are and how much of the food industry they control?
Yeah, it depends on which section of the food system and which product you're looking at. So I'm going to be talking about three products, beer, bag salad, and soy milk. So in beer, it's really two dominant firms right now, Anheuser-Busch InBev and Miller Coors. For bag salad, it's also two big companies, and then one company that's very big in the organic space, which is Earthbound Farms, which is now owned by White Wave. Soy milk is really dominated by White Wave also, so it's even more concentrated than some of the industries I'm looking at than just four firms controlling 40% of the market. It's more like one or two firms controlling 70% of the market.
Now, if you were looking at a consumer product, wouldn't that sort of attract antitrust interest from the government if two companies owned 70, 80% of the market?
Well, it used to be that way. In fact, in the 50s, when a couple of beer companies were considering combining, they would have had about a 4.5% market share, and the Supreme Court undid that. They wouldn't allow it to go through. But things really changed in the 1980s. Reagan was elected. The people he appointed to regulatory agencies really changed the way antitrust laws were interpreted, and then federal judges also began kind of dramatically reinterpreting these laws at that time. Part of the reason was that they had been, gone on these all-expense-paid junkets to play golf in places like Arizona and Florida, which were funded by think tanks that got a lot of corporate funding, and they schooled these judges in the Chicago School of Economics theories on why antitrust isn't really an issue for consumers and shouldn't be regulated the same way it was prior to that.
So you saw this concentration in the 1980s. I think of things like Archer Daniels Midland, which really was controlling everything from seed to finished product in like corn and soybeans and the like. Are those still concerns today, those particular sort of seed to product providers?
Yeah, there's a chapter in my book where I focus on grain collectors like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill. And they've actually increased their power since the 80s. They've been acquiring other competitors. So, for example, in milling, three of the most dominant firms have actually combined to form a joint venture. So they control a pretty significant percentage of the collecting of wheat and the selling of wheat to bakers. So, it's something that you just couldn't have imagined, at the beginning of the 1980s that's happening right now.
Are we seeing, with that concentration, higher food prices, or is it more of an efficiency mode for the consumers now, or a bit of both?
Well, efficiency is the rhetoric that's often used to justify these mergers, but the effect is increased economic power, and most of that power has been applied to the sellers. So if you're selling wheat to a processor, you're probably more harmed than consumers are at this point, although consumers are also seeing higher prices in industries that are very concentrated. Particular categories like soft drinks, breakfast cereals, snacks, those prices are often much higher than the material cost compared to other foods.
Now, it seems like not too long ago we were looking at like major price spikes in like corn and wheat to an extent, and I'm not sure if wheat was more a reaction to more people growing corn when the corn price spiked. Did these mega corporations have much to do with that huge price spike a few years ago, or was that more a function of bad weather and the usual crop failures and crop surpluses sort of situation?
Yeah, it's really complicated because there were a lot of factors involved, you know, the increase in fossil fuel prices at that time, weather, increasing demand around the world, speculators that were trying to corner the market on certain crops. But the biggest beneficiaries of those price increases were, you know, people downstream from the farmers. The farmers got higher prices for a short time, but they were also paying much higher prices for inputs like seed and fertilizers at the same time. So typically in these situations, you know, the more powerful firms are able to benefit from whatever volatilities there are in the market.
Well, earlier you mentioned that right now with some of these large conglomerates, they're putting more pricing pressure on the growers. What sort of pricing pressures are they doing? I mean, I assume if they control the seed, they're controlling sort of the market rate for the grown product and produce. That gives them huge leverage over farmers.
Yeah, in some cases it's different firms that are selling the seeds and then buying the grains that are collected, but there are also alliances between seed companies and grain collectors, alliances between, for example, Monsanto and Cargill. And seed prices have gone up quite a bit until just recently, so farmers haven't really benefited from, you know, seed prices increase much faster than the rate of inflation and even other inputs. But that's starting to slow down, and that's why these big six seed companies and chemical companies are now trying to all merge with each other. And if they all the proposed ones go through, we could be down to four or even three big seed chemical companies in the entire world.
Wow, just three in the entire world?
Yeah.
You know, you're finally seeing, I guess, an antitrust spine being grown on some of the most recent mergers here. Is there any sense that there's opposition to these mergers from, say, like a court sort of looking at how much market share these companies control?
Yeah, I know there are members of Congress right now expressing a lot of concern about the proposed mergers. You know, we would go from three seed chemical corporations based in the U.S. to just one if they all go through as planned. So there's concern about these inputs being controlled by firms based in China for one and Germany for the other of the top three. So right now, you know, those first two were with ChemChina acquiring Syngenta, a Swiss firm, and then DuPont and Dow merging. Those looked like they were going to go through with, you know, some minor divestitures. But this third proposal for Bayer to acquire Monsanto, it might be at a tipping point where it triggers enough resistance that maybe the Department of Justice you know, will do something to stop it. Right now, analysts suggest it's about 50-50. The odds might not even be that high. It might be 30 to 40% based on what investors are paying for stock prices of those two firms that it will actually go through.
My guest today is Philip Howard, an associate professor in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University. He's a member of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems and author of Concentration and Power in the Food System, Who Controls What We Eat? He'll be speaking on that subject in Terrell Hall for the Center for Humanities at the University of Tulsa tonight, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, what's the shakedown for consumers in having, say, three seed and chemical companies in the world, or two major brewers of beer for, you know, since you're going to be talking about beer, you know, having Anheuser-Busch and Miller Coors as the two huge conglomerates here in this country? Yet, you know, when you look at beer, there are hundreds of craft beers.
Yeah, that's why beer is so fascinating, because what we've seen is some really dramatic price increases for consumers after the Belgian firm InBev acquired Anheuser-Busch. They immediately raised prices, and they controlled about half the market at that time. Miller Coors controlled another 30%, and so Miller Coors simply matched those prices. And then they did it again a few years later. The Department of Justice noted these price increases and actually blocked an attempt by InBev to acquire a full stake in Modelo, a Mexican beer giant. They already owned about half of it. So that was blocked, but just in the U.S., and it went through in the rest of the world, and they had to license Corona and other beers to another firm, another wine giant Constellation. So beer consumers have seen price increases. You know, they've increased much faster than other alcoholic beverages like wine and spirits. But on the other hand, because of the craft brews, we have almost 5,000 breweries in this country now. It's a really dramatic change from the late 70s when there were only 50 breweries in the entire United States. So
it's almost a change to like pre-prohibition days when every town had a brewery and you had a home brand in every city.
Yeah, I don't think we're there per capita yet, but, mm-hmm. but there are actually now more breweries in the U.S. than there were before prohibition. Yeah, exactly right. People have a lot of options, you know, at the local level to buy a beer that's not this mass-produced pale lager. There are a lot of other brewing styles that are available now, and people are experimenting with many more. And there was this pent-up demand for people who wanted other options. And the price differential is actually narrowing because the mass brewers have increased their prices so much, and some of these smaller breweries have scaled up and have become national firms. So more and more people are recognizing the benefits by paying just a little bit more for those craft brews. And they are growing at almost exponential rates in the last 6 years.
Well, you know, when you look over the last 6 years, last decade, it seems like people are more willing to spend more for what they consider to be a locally brewed, or if not even locally brewed, sort of the craft taken as opposed to a mass consumable. It's almost like, you know, going for a local delicacy as opposed to mass-produced fast food.
Yeah, and it's becoming more like Germany and other places where they never really lost that local beer culture. I mean, it was such a big shift after Prohibition. It was only the very big firms that were able to survive not being in the alcohol business for so long that now we're finally getting back to where we were before Prohibition.
Is the story this consolidation of a product sort of spurred the craft beer movement, or was the craft beer movement happening anyway, and just this consolidation was maybe in reaction to the growth of craft beers?
Yeah, I think consolidation was occurring before home brewing became legal again in 1978, and that created an option for people to resist that consolidation. So it's a little bit of both. People just simply have a lot more options than they used to now.
Do you think it's the homogenization of your major brands, the fact that they're all pale lagers, and pretty much, and what you've seen with craft brews is that, yes, we may have a pale lager, but we have IPAs, we have, you know, all sorts of dark beers, we have, you know, all sorts of ways of brewing beer. And that's sort of appealed to people's taste, or by consolidation, you just sort of get a homogenization of all these large, large mass-produced beers where they taste basically the same.
Yeah, I think in any case where you have a lot of consolidation and less competition, there tends to be less innovation, and that's what happened to the beer industry. But the new competition from craft brews is forcing the big brewers to respond. So they're doing things like introducing crafty beers that they produce themselves but are priced and look like craft beers, things like Shock Top from Anheuser-Busch. And in the last couple of years, they've actually been buying up a lot of real craft brewers. Anheuser-Busch bought Goose Island in Chicago a few years ago, but they've bought half a dozen more just in the last couple of years, and Miller Coors has bought another five.
Again, is it an attempt to just control market share?
Yeah, the big brewers are actually losing market share. They peaked at about the top two at 80% a few years ago, but sales of those mass-produced beers are declining in most very industrialized countries, and at the expense of craft brews. So buying up craft brews and introducing fake craft brews is just about the only option for them to try and increase their sales.
Well, is this a story where the market sort of responded to consolidation, or is it something more complex?
Yeah, it's more complex because there are government regulations that interact with those markets in so many ways. After Prohibition, we had a three-tier distribution system, so it became very difficult for craft brewers to sell beyond just their local brewery. To get into local retailers was very difficult for a long time. They had to overcome a number of obstacles, and now some of them are doing very well. But still, in most supermarkets, it's Anheuser-Busch or Miller Coors that controls that shelf space. They decide who's going to go where, how much space they get, at what level. So there's still all kinds of ways that government regulations and the actions of retailers are constraining the growth of craft beer even more. Craft beer would be growing more than it would otherwise without all of these factors.
Now, the other two foods you're going to concentrate on are one is something that maybe 10 years ago you never saw, and that was a bagged salad, and soy milk, which is really both have grown over the last 10 years. And again, you say it's just a couple of suppliers. In fact, when I think of bagged salads, I think of maybe Dole, and that's about it. I can't even think of the other bagged salad provider.
Yeah, there's another name brand that's owned by Chiquita. So those two big fresh produce firms, Dole and Chiquita, control a big chunk of the market. But yeah, you're right. These are fairly recent innovations tied to the growth of organic foods. These were things that were innovated by organic growers and processors. And one of the keys to making them mainstream, but yet also being dominated by a few firms, was shelf space. Most retailers in the U.S. charge slotting fees to put a product on their shelves.
So you're talking about grocery stores charge a fee for, say, the big providers to say, okay, you get this much room.
Yeah, I mean, if you, say, had a pickle business and you wanted to put a jar of pickles on the shelves in a regional retail chain, it's very secretive, but some estimates are that that would cost you tens of thousands of dollars. You would have to pay tens of thousands of dollars to those retailers just to get on their shelves. So that made it very difficult for these products that used to be just in natural food stores to break into the mainstream. So they had to get funding from very big corporations to help with pay those slotting fees. But once they did that, there was very little competition. They were the only ones paying those fees. And so they were able to increase their brand awareness very quickly and become very dominant. So in the case of soy milk, putting it right next to conventional milk, cow's milk, that was a lot more effective than the previous strategy of putting it in shelf-stable cartons somewhere else in the store where people weren't thinking about milk.
And when I think of something like soy milk, I think this is a product that's ripe for consolidation, because when I think of soybeans, you just think of your mass-produced corn, your mass-produced wheat, it being just these huge conglomerations that can control just about everything from seed to final product. And we think of soybeans mainly as a product that is added to other products, not a soy product for its own use.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's actually pretty easy to make your own soy milk at home.
Really?
Cook the soybeans, blend them, and strain them.
Uh-huh.
And so that's one of the ways people are resisting these trends is, they're making their own soy milk at home, making their own beer at home, or, in the case of bagged salads, realizing it's a lot cheaper just to buy a head of lettuce and wash it and chop it yourself.
And that was one question I had was, what is the local foods movement doing for, say, something like bagged salads or even just produce? I mean, even in our local grocery stores, you're seeing consumer pressure to purchase locally, and now at least some groceries here are saying, okay, these tomatoes are from Arkansas. They're not from California. They're not from Mexico. They're not from Canada grown hydroponically. They're grown in Arkansas, or they're grown here within the state. They're telling you where that product is from. Is that making much of a dent in the control by these large corporations of processed, even things like bagged salad, which you think of, okay, it's just lettuce and veggies tossed together, but by putting it in a bag, it's processed.
Yeah, it is making a difference, particularly when, for example, there's an outbreak of a foodborne disease linked to bagged salads. That's when sales of local leafy greens really take off and sales of the national products really suffer. The challenge in sourcing local foods is the growers are not as big. It's hard to source an adequate supply for a big retail chain. The season is shorter than it is in a place like California. But it is encouraging to see consumer demand leading to so many retailers trying to support local and regional growers.
Is a farmer's market still the main area where you're going to see the local food movement thrive? Should they just never count on really having traditional grocery stores or supermarkets as a source of local foods?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, retailers as big as Walmart have started promoting what they call local foods, although it may mean just coming from a very large grower within those state boundaries. Farmers markets are growing very rapidly, but they still account for just a fraction of food sales. But that's the place where you can be more sure if you're at a market where the rules are the growers there have to be directly involved in the food production. You're going to be able to talk to them and know a lot more about that product. But we are starting to see a lot more retailers make real efforts to source local foods, although there are also there's a lot of greenwashing going on, like some retailers in the Northwest would create fake farmers markets where they would put produce displays outside the store and they'd have chalkboards and they would actually call them farmers markets, even though it was produce from all around the world.
And I assume another version of greenwashing would be what might be large farmer stands, but they're using purveyors just like restaurants and anywhere else are, and they're getting their produce from California.
Yeah, that's why there's kind of a burden on the consumer to understand what kind of market it really is. Is it a real farmer's market where it's local growers selling their products, or is it something that looks like a farmer's market and it's just a produce market?
Is that a growing trend among farmers markets to sort of stipulate that the sellers have to be involved in the actual production of the food?
Yeah, because of consumer interest. I know in my area in Michigan, there are some that have very strict rules, and people who oversee the market will actually go out and visit the farms to make sure they're actually producing what they say they're selling at the market. Others are a little less strict, and you know, some of them have like segregated areas where here are the real farmers and here are people who are sourcing from everywhere else.
And of course, there's others where there's probably no rules.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, now, one of the things you're going to talk about is how consumers can sort of fight back against big corporate control of what goes on our table. What are some of the hints you consider to be essential for people to be more knowledgeable food consumers?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, it's a challenge to be informed and know who's really producing our food. There are so many brands where the corporate parentage is not clear. It's not on the packaging. It's not on the website. But there are tools, there are apps like Good Guide and Buycott, B-U-Y-C-O-T-T, where you can just take a picture of the barcode and pull up a lot of information about that product, including who really owns it and a number of other criteria. So that's one way, is to become more informed, to become more self-reliant by doing more of our own processing, things like the more and more people are brewing their own beer. And then, you know, people are organizing to address some of the negative impacts of these trends, things like for soft drinks in particular. There's been a lot of action around putting higher taxes, regulating the serving size, you know, pulling vending machines out of schools. All of those things have been effective at local levels.
You mentioned that a lot of times big corporations that own multiple brands will try to hide their ownership of the brand. How systematic is that?
It's pretty common, particularly in product categories where consumers are kind of skeptical of big brands. Like if you have a craft beer, the big brewers are not going to have their names attached. If you have a processed organic food, you're not going to have a big corporation like General Mills or Kellogg with their name anywhere near those products. Other products, it's a little more common, especially if you go to a website. I mean, ConAgra has more than 70 different brands, which you can easily see at their website, but people may not realize how many products within one category they own. I mean, they have four different brands of margarine, for example.
Now, a lot of these are done through acquisitions. Is the sort of local control still in force for a lot of these acquisitions, or does it just become part of the, you know, the global food company?
Yeah, I mean, most antitrust actions are taken at the national level, but the increasingly global scope of these firms makes it very difficult. You know, these recent mergers in the seed chemical industry, they need sign-offs in the European Union and the U.S. and China and countries all over the world, and that makes it very complicated. You know, just one could hold up that merger, but, you know, looking at the global global scope of competition, that's kind of another argument these firms use to say, look, we're competing against global firms. You can't look just at the national market in trying to stop this merger from going through.
Would you say today that the concentration in the food system is growing? Is it sort of waning a bit, or is it growing at about the same rate it has been?
In most industries, it's been increasing, but it's not always steady. So in the seed chemical industry, for example, there was a lot of buying up of smaller firms, but the big firms weren't buying up each other until the last year or so. Now we're starting to see that happen, and just some of the biggest deals ever are happening right now. But, you know, there are some industries where the growth is really slow. In the wine industry, for example, there have been so many mergers. I mean, there's so many new wineries coming online that are creating new competitors, and the big three firms that control half the market haven't really grown that much.
Do you think that is, as you see market share concentrated within a few firms, you'll see new firms pop up to take advantage of the fact that, you know, so much of a share is controlled by what is in essence one company, or will it just make it harder for those people to enter the marketplace?
Yeah, it really depends on the industry, because often the reason a few firms have been able to become so dominant is that they put a lot of hurdles in front of their competitors. But sometimes they go so far or do so little innovation that it creates new spaces for new competitors to come in.
You've certainly seen that with alcohol, with beer and wine, for example.
Yeah, and even soft drinks, which, you know, have been dominated by Coke and Pepsi for decades, because people are looking for, you know, soft drinks without high fructose corn syrup, with real sugar. That created the space for a lot of very small companies. There was also innovation in things like energy drinks and teas and flavored waters that led to all these new firms that, many of which ended up being acquired by Coke and Pepsi.
And that's I guess, that if you, once you become so successful, the next thing is fending off the big food systems from purchasing you and buying you up.
Yeah, and it's very tough to do. And in the organic industry, for example, you know, there are a number of firms that are very idealistic and have refused tremendous buyout offers. But that's tough to do when you're now competing with some of the biggest corporations in the world.
And if you go public in any sort of way, then your investors want a return on their investment.
Yeah, the Ben & Jerry's found that out, that once they went public, they really had no recourse but to be acquired by Unilever, for example.
Well, we look forward to your talk, Professor Howard. Philip Howard, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Philip Howard is an associate professor in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University and a member of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems. He'll be speaking on Food and Power, How Big Corporations Shape What We Eat and Drink, this evening at 7 in Tyrrell Hall Auditorium, and a free lecture sponsored by the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities at the University of Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.